It's The Wonky Show. We're talking science and society, postgrads, a policy exchange report, and student accommodation in Scotland. It's all coming up.
Got a system and a way that the student accommodation market works where much of the marketing and the encouragement to sign up for student accommodation is done months and months in advance, in some cases November and December of the year before. So students have signed up to accommodation contracts for an academic year 9 months in, or so in advance. And you know, for many of students now, plans are going to change.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your direct way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's Editor-in-Chief, Mark Leach, and joined by three brilliant guests this morning to help us wade through the policy fjords. In London, we have David Malcolm, Head of Policy for the National Union of Students. David, reason for optimism this week?
Well, I've been working at home like everyone else, and my window looks out onto a hedge, and I've got some sparrows nesting in the hedge, and it's been very soothing watching them sort of bounce in and out with bits of twigs and food and all sorts of other things in their mouths, and it's just nice to know that life continues as normal for at least some creatures on this earth.
And in Glasgow, we have Rachel Sanderson, Vice Principal, External Relations for the University of Glasgow. Rachel, tell us a highlight of the week, please.
Oh, wow. So many, actually. The sun is shining in Glasgow and has been now for weeks, which is quite a revelation. Also, I'm a new auntie, so my sister gave birth to a baby boy. Yes, so my wee nephew, Sunny, has arrived, which is a huge reason to be cheerful and optimistic. And on a slightly different note, I did find out yesterday that my favourite pizza restaurant in Glasgow is reopening this weekend for takeaway and delivery, which has brought me complete and utter joy. So yes, lots of reasons to be cheerful.
And also in London, we have Wonky's editor, Debbie McVitty. Debbie, tell us something that's cheered you up this week.
Well, in the continuation of the animal theme, our little kittens have cheered me up this week because they've been super cute and they're coming and sitting on my lap, and that's just been lovely.
Right. It's 20 years since the Influential Science and Society report was published. Debbie, tell us, why did it matter and why are we talking about it on Wonky so much this week?
Well, we can all agree that COVID-19 has created an opportunity kind of amid the gloom to showcase the best of UK science and research. But in the past couple of weeks, there's been a series of controversies about scientific advice and how it works to shape government policy. So we've had the resignation of Neil Ferguson from the Scientific Advisory Group on Emergencies, or SAGE, as we'll call it from now on, because he was found to have broken the lockdown rules. We've had questions over secrecy of membership of SAGE. And then when the membership list was published last week, there was questions about whether it was sufficiently independent of government and whether it covered a broad enough range of expertise. And in the wake of that, we've had the creation of a new shadow group calling itself Independent SAGE, which has been created under the auspices of former Chief Scientific Advisor Sir David King. And that group's been particularly critical of how government has been engaging with science and has sort of questioned how the government is presenting science in its press conferences and communications. And then the latest is that there's been further challenge over the government's research sustainability task force and the transparency of the membership on that. So that was published just yesterday. And I think all of these instances open up a debate about the role of science in policy making, about questions of transparency and accountability, about not just how science informs policy, but how the public has input into scientific priorities and how the public sort of engages with science in a meaningful way. And it's something we'd been working on before COVID-19 hit. 20 years ago, the House of Lords Science and Technology Committee published a report which was not groundbreaking in the sense that it was sort of picking up on, I think, sort of trends in the discipline anyway around questions about science's engagement with the public, but it was certainly noteworthy because it was a kind of a spark for quite a lot of activity, and that report basically recommended a shift from the dominant model of public understanding of science, which kind of called to mind this idea of kind of expert scientists, you know, declaiming from on high to a grateful and ill-informed public, and that sort of became known as the deficit model of public engagement, to proposing a more democratic model in which the public, sort of users of science, funders of science, and scientific institutions would be kind of co-producing science in a more in a much more democratic way, and that became known as the model of public engagement in science. So we were, as I say, we were working on this before COVID-19 hit. COVID-19 and some of the issues that I've just described really brought these questions about public trust in science, about the role of science in shaping government policy, into sharp relief. So we've convened some really useful thinking on these topics, which I won't go into in detail, but I strongly commend to our listeners.
Thanks, Abby. And Rachel, you work for a major research intensive university, and it feels like science is having a real moment right now, and I'm interested to know how that's filtering through your university community during the crisis.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. I think, we felt a little bit battered, I think, across the higher education sector for a number of years now in this kind of revolt against the academy and experts. And it does feel like the pandemic is giving us an opportunity to really showcase the importance of research within the higher education sector and the very direct societal impact that can have. At Glasgow, we are actually hosting the National Testing Centre for Scotland, the Lighthouse Lab, which has just been utterly tremendous. And we have over 800 volunteers from across our university community that are literally testing 24/7 in that lab. So I do think that this does provide an opportunity for us to pivot a little and really shine a spotlight on the incredible, incredible research activity that universities deliver on behalf of society. And we are very much in the front line of the fight against COVID-19.
I wonder if any of you, I mean, we've been talking about this in Wonky the last few days, but, you know, science is never non-political, and there's a lot of row over, a lot of controversy over membership of these different groups. So we've got the, first of all, SAGE, then the sort of opposition SAGE, and now the government's research task force. They all seem inherently political in their both in their kind of makeup and also their purpose.
I was really interested to listen to the Independent SAGE press conference this week, because that very question about the political affiliation of the group, and it's sort of known that the political affiliation of the group is more towards the left than perhaps would be considered mainstream. And this question was put to Sir David King by a journalist from the Daily Mail, and Sir David King said this is completely irrelevant. It is, you know, we didn't look at political affiliations when assembling this group, and you know, can I ask you please to focus on the science and not on sort of inanities, basically. And I think, you know, I think there's a question here about is it reasonable to expect scientists in any context to put aside their political affiliations? Because if you consider that political affiliations do represent values and kind of perspectives on the world, you know, is it reasonable to expect them to put that aside in thinking about how they produce science, draw on science to formulate advice to government? I would argue no, but at the same time, I'm sort of wary of a model that says we must publish the affiliations of everyone who takes on these sorts of roles, partly because of the risk to the individuals involved, and partly because I think it does people a disservice to some extent to suggest that they can, you know, that they can't take a view that is, if not necessarily independent of their politics, that they can be sort of sufficiently conscious of their own politics to be mindful of what the implications of that might be for how they're presenting information. But I can also see that would be very much hedging it for a lot of people who would feel that kind of transparency and accountability are very much compromised by such a view.
I wonder if anyone's got a view about what we should be asking of the government's new research task force. Again, another thing, the membership was kept secret, and it's just been revealed in the last 24 hours, to include sector figures, vice chancellors, and the relevant ministers in Scotland and Wales.
I think part of the issue, of course, is that trust in politicians is really low. And when they're seen to be involved in either interpreting or enacting scientific advice, I think it can accept perceptions. And, you know, you can witness the concern about the idea that Dominic Cummings was attending the meetings of original SAGE, as people being concerned that if he was involved as a sort of Svengali figure, that what would come out of that would necessarily be sort of tainted or sort of pulled towards the what the government needs the scientific advice to say in order to make itself look good. And so I think any time that, you know, because it's trust in politicians, it's that sort of fear that it's so low, it's that fear that that will kind of affect the trust in science and the scientific advice. And again, you can sort of see that across the pond in America, where Trump and Anthony Fauci are sort of this strange double act every time there's a press conference, it's only by Trump's sort of egregiousness in terms of making up scientific theories as he stands there that the trust remains, I think, in Dr. Fauci to be giving good advice to the American public. But I think it can also be kind of overdone in terms of the chatter in the newspapers. There was a Cervation poll last week that said that 64% of people agreed that they trusted scientists more now as a result of the crisis. But equally, I think the point that Debbie was making about the value that people place in transparency is definitely there. 97% in the same poll said that the data should be public, so that the public do want to be engaged in what's going on and understand why the scientific advice is what it is.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hello, Wonky listeners. My name's Victoria Holbrook, and I'm the Assistant Director for Governance at Advance HG. My piece this week is about valuing diversity in governance, and it has been on my mind for quite some time. We all know that board diversity needs to improve further, but the reason that this is so important now is because we're going through such major change. We need the brightest minds from all backgrounds and perspectives to help us determine our new strategies. And the crux of it is this: who gets to inform and make decisions matters, and it really matters now more than ever. It's about avoiding blind spots, it's about innovating, but it's also about stakeholder engagement, confidence and trust. So I'm making the case that board diversity needs to be addressed right now if we're to come out of this stronger, and I propose some ways that this could be done. So I hope you enjoyed it.
Hi, I'm Holly Baker. I'm the Deputy Head of Whining Participation and Outreach at the University of Surrey. I've written a quick piece about the implications of school closures for disadvantaged students, not only those hoping to enter higher education this year, but also the knock-on effect that it will have on students for years to come. Firstly, it explores the measures that have been put in place to assess students this year to avoid the risks associated with predicted grades, and the reality that actually underpredicting grades is just one component that of our education system that disadvantages already disadvantaged students. There are so many other things that have happened up to this point already that aren't kind of being considered, I suppose. It looks at the education disadvantage gap, it's currently on average around 18 months, and how this period of homeschooling is likely to increase this gap, and also what it means that students don't have opportunities to access IED cultural and to develop cultural capital. And how this is likely actually to continue when schools go back as well. And then finally, it looks at opportunities that we as WP teams, as UniConnect partnerships, should be focusing on at this point, and how we can make the most of this period where students are at home with their families, particularly students that are disadvantaged, and how we can try and ensure that learning is happening as a family and together, which hopefully will be more impactful and more meaningful for the future as well.
Now, this week, HEPI's published a major report into the state of postgraduate education in the UK. Rachel, what are your key takeaways from this?
Yeah, so new report from HEPI published today, which does explore the state of postgraduate education over the past decade, and it builds on the two earlier reports HEPI released in 2004 and 2010. And I think what it really highlights is a period of extreme turmoil in postgraduate numbers over the past decade, with both positive and negative outcomes. But I think it's worthwhile remembering that this is a decade where we have faced the 2008 financial crisis, the change to student funding, removal of the post-study work visa, and of course Brexit, which we haven't been talking as much about of late, but of course is still there on the horizon. I think all of that being said, actually, the report is fairly positive in its conclusion that overall there has been a 16% growth in postgraduate study, and particularly a marked growth in international student numbers studying in the UK, mainly thanks to Chinese students who are coming for postgraduate study at our universities. So other key headlines that have come out of this report is that, perhaps unsurprisingly, the introduction of postgraduate loans for study at master's level has led to a marked increase in UK domicile student numbers following several years of decline or stagnation. But there has been a significant decline in numbers of older part-time students accessing lifelong learning, and of course a decline in EU domicile students from 2016 as a result of Brexit. There has been some interesting research as well around the growing imbalance between female and male postgraduates. And also the fact that TNE has grown significantly over that period. So we now have more international postgraduates studying for UK postgraduate programmes overseas than we do in the UK. In fact, TNE students have more than doubled since 2007-2008. The one last thing actually that I would pick up from the report is just that master's loans have really improved participation among students from disadvantaged backgrounds. And I found this particularly pleasing, that students from disadvantaged backgrounds now make up 49% of the cohort. And that's actually up from 35% in 2008-2009.
David, tell us about the WP agenda and postgrads.
I think obviously it's something that when the postgraduate loans were being discussed was a hot topic, was that, you know, the idea that postgraduate study and particularly top masters was the new frontier in widening participation, that because only the kind of better off students could access it, that it was replicating the issues and the disparities between different social groups just by, instead of at the undergraduate level where it was previously, now extending that to postgraduate level. So it was absolutely the right intention, I think, to open up postgraduate study and make sure that those students who couldn't afford to pay this out of their own pockets or their family finances, that they could get access to this. But I do have some concerns around that. I think that loans have opened up that access, is there's no question. But the repayment conditions are designed to ensure that loans are cost neutral to the public purse. And that's quite a significant consideration in terms of when you go out into the workplace afterwards, the kind of cost of that to you. And especially then, if you choose to then go on to do doctoral study and you're taking a further loan on top of that to pay for that study. And it's not, of course, that loans are the only way you fund this, or indeed family. What is also notable to me, I think, is that over the period, there's been a significant decline in funding from employers to do this sort of study. And this is sort of this is something we've already seen with the extension of loans for part-time undergraduate study. And the analysis that was done by individuals like Claire Callender and others showed that that was a result of a combination of reduced training budgets by employers, an increase in fees that meant that they were less willing to stump up the cash when they did have the budget, and of course them saying that, well, if you've got loans, you don't need that sponsorship anymore. But what I worry about that is that the people that continue to get employer sponsorship and therefore don't pay for this are going to be those who are in better off situations from better off social backgrounds. And similarly, in doctoral study, you know, those who can access the Research Council studentships, which mean that you don't pay fees and you get some money for your maintenance. Again, I would be quite confident there are some biases there. And again, it will be students from better off backgrounds, from sort of demographics who, we know have some of the advantages in society, who will get those studentships more likely, whereas again poorer students and others have to rely on loans. So I do worry that the introduction of the loans, that we have to be very careful that it doesn't actually in some ways exacerbate some of the inequalities that it's actually trying to address.
Yeah, you've always got to be a bit careful when you're talking about data on socioeconomic background of postgraduates, because it's one of those data things that's incredibly hard to measure. But there does seem to be some indication that introducing the loan has led to increase of participation among the most disadvantaged groups, and kind of pullers and socioeconomic classification are the kind of two ways that you can try and at least get a snapshot of that. But it also seems to have increased participation by perhaps a greater amount among the most advantaged. So there's a question, I think, about the when you're thinking about whether to do postgraduate, you're obviously, you know, there's a kind of question about the sort of interest in the subject and stuff like that. But I think in some ways it's a more kind of classically rational question about, you know, is this worth the investment for a student thinking about whether to do it? And that's what I think is one thing that's quite interesting about this report, is this question about different groups that get a better return on investment. Because if you think about, I mean, what we know from longitudinal educational outcomes is the salary differentials vary enormously by not only things like region and university of study, but also gender, social class, those sorts of things. And though I hear what you're saying, David, about the kind of concerns about the kind of the replication of existing inequalities, I do wonder whether, in the same way as the payoff for women in terms of the salary outcome in particular is greater because women are more disadvantaged in the labour market overall, may also be true for disadvantaged students, which is not necessarily to say that, you know, it is of course fundamentally unfair that you know, women and or disadvantaged students and or other kind of less advantaged groups would need to invest in a postgraduate in order to be, to secure that advantage. But it certainly, I think, needs to be formed part of the calculation.
And I would agree with that, Debbie. And I think that the report does try to call some of that out. And in fact, you know, the growing imbalance between female and male postgraduates, which stand at sort of 60 to 40 respectively, that's partly due to the fact that there is much higher female participation in teaching and nursing. So those particular areas. So it might not necessarily be that women in PG has grown overall. It's just that women in particular programmes has grown as a result of those professional pathways being required to get graduate employment. And I think there is an issue around the salary piece in particular. So although it says that postgraduate study benefits women more, it's because of the lower salary thresholds in the first place that it's a very complicated picture. I think you've always got to look at all of this data and apply some context to it.
That's also true of BAME participation, isn't it? Because there's some indication that particularly Black Caribbean British people may be actually slightly overrepresented at postgraduate study. And certainly I know that the Times this morning led with kind of fewer white men in postgraduate study. And I think that becomes a problem if you are confident that every form of postgraduate study confers a social advantage. And of course, you know, if we're talking about more postgraduate nursing, initial teacher training, you know, these are absolutely fantastic pathways, but they are also kind of requirements to enter the field. And therefore, you know, we have to kind of look at particular segments of postgraduate study and the kind of patterns there, as well as looking at the overall picture.
I think one of the other things that's really interesting that the report calls out quite starkly is the growth being buoyed by international students, and of course international students from China in particular, which make up 38% of the postgraduate cohort. And actually, you know, the report does flag that, of course, this was analysis that was done pre-COVID-19, and actually, what will the next few years look like for the sector? As a result of the impact of the pandemic and student choice around travel and still coming to the UK for international education?
That seems to me the critical question. And in the context of what we're likely to see a global recession, if not a depression, what is that likely to do to demand, Debbie?
The data in the report was brought together before COVID-19 hit, but the author, Ginevra House, does speculate that, well, you know, we're almost certainly going to see a severe dip in international postgraduate study, although the transnational provision, some forms of that may be able to continue, and there's a potential ray of light there. But actually, the suspicion is that home postgraduate demand may increase as a result of bad economic circumstances. Certainly that was, I think, modestly true at the last financial crisis. And one shouldn't probably be too cheerful about that, because of course, you know, people doing postgraduate study, you hope that it's because of the kind of, you know, positive calculation about the benefit to them and the value for them. But that could be a feature of the year to come.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, assuming EU students have to pay international fees after Brexit transition period, it is predicted that numbers may decline by 60%. So that's over 11,000 fewer EU students studying at our universities. And, you know, that in some ways, you know, if you're just looking plainly at the economics, some universities may say, well, okay, that's fine on the basis that we still have a very healthy number of fee-paying international students from other parts of the world. But there is just no certainty that will now be the case. And, you know, predictions by Simon Marginson and others are saying that, you know, the impact of COVID-19 will be felt by the higher education sector for a five-year period. So we need to be really realistic about what international growth is going to look like. And actually now how realistic the government's international strategy is, I think not very, unless the government actually really works closely with the sector to ensure we have the right policies in place to support international growth. And, you know, we need to be able to move on post-study work being reintroduced. You know, I think we're getting lots of positive noises that this will happen over the summer, but it actually hasn't yet. And we need to get those messages out to the marketplace. But we also need to look at prioritising international immigration post-COVID-19 in the way that the Australian sector now has, and that will require government support to make happen.
And I think that even for domestic student recruitment, whilst I would agree in any normal recession, as it were, you would expect to see an increase in demand for education given the option of that or unemployment, But I think this is not a normal recession, and some of the same calculations for postgraduate study will surely apply for all the things we've been discussing as regards undergraduate study. So do people feel they'll get the quality of education that they would want in a scenario where they're not sure if they'll be able to attend the campus and they're not certain about the whether online education is the right thing for them? So I think will need to be a consideration, or certainly might dampen some of that demand that otherwise would arrive.
All lockdown, we're running Wonky at Home, a series of online events exploring different aspects of higher education policy in the COVID landscape and presenting new thinking about how we get out of the crisis and what happens next. Go to wonky.com/events to find out more and book your place. Now, Policy Exchange has published a new report from David Goodhart on how the crisis presents an opportunity for government to reshape the education landscape. David, what's your take?
Well, I think the wonk community tends to look quite closely at anything that Policy Exchange says at the moment, because, of course, one of Gavin Williamson's special advisors, Ian Mansfield, was their head of education immediately prior to him taking up that role. And this isn't one of his reports, to be clear. This is from David Goodhart, the author of The Road to Somewhere. So it was, you know, quite notable a few years back when assessing what was happening around Brexit and sort of how the country's political divides have changed. In his framing from those are people of somewhere and those are people of anywhere. And he's so actually quite a blue Labour figure, so he's also been sort of influential in that debate within the opposition party. And so he's written this report that's about saying there's an opportunity here to use the crisis to address some of the problems he perceives in the UK's training and education at sort of tertiary level. And I think if you wanted to be slightly jaundiced about it, well, when I was reading the report earlier this week, my first thought was that, you know, the opening sort of introduction and first few paragraphs is really just a Telegraph article, I thought, and although it turned out it was a Spectator article because that's been published this morning. And you know, if you want to play HE article bingo, then you can you know, circle the references to Germany's vocational education system. You can tick off referring to further education as the Cinderella sector. There's a disparaging mention of the 50% target, etc. So to some extent, it, you know, although it's a think tank report, it doesn't come across as you know, delivering any particularly new analysis. But then you get to the ideas, and he's got three ideas for what should happen to training in the UK. And he believes that two can be done relatively simply, and one is a bit more medium term. So the first is an opportunity grant. He says that all adults should be given £3,000 in grant form with top-up loans for more expensive study. And it's basically going to be available to all individuals and enable them to take up courses broadly in further education, although he sort of hints that some sort of higher education might be possible around this. And it's a sort of a variation on the proposals in the OGG report for a lifelong learning loan, similarly the Lib Dem Lifelong Learning Commission's recommendations for a new form of individual learning account, although more of this in grant form than either of those two reports suggested. And indeed at NUS we've been suggesting something very similar for study leavers coming out into to the coronavirus world in the next few months. But I think whilst it's a good idea on the whole, and you need to guard against the abuses he mentions that was a feature of the system of individual learning accounts that was introduced in the early 2000s, I think that obviously there are some barriers in creating the capacity at speed if everyone were to take this up. And there's no mention, as is often the case with these sorts of proposals, of how students are meant to have, you know, support their living and course costs during study. The second proposal he comes up with is a new model of apprenticeship education. He wants to completely replace the current apprenticeship model, and this is all in England, by the way, with what he calls a radically simplified model, where the government funds 50% of apprentices and employers fund the other 50%, but directed solely at school leavers up to the age of 24. And I think it's quite ambitious to say that that's a simple solution, that you just replace the entire apprenticeship system overnight. And regardless of the merit of ideas anyway, the employers at the moment, you know, what we're getting through at NUS is some sense that the employers just aren't offering apprentices at the moment. New starts have slumped, and employers, because of all the challenges they're facing, apprenticing aren't wanting to start new apprentice programs. So I think, again, regardless of whether or not we have the right system at the moment, the problems it's facing aren't necessarily going to be solved by that approach. And finally, and perhaps most of interest to the higher education sector, he proposes a slightly more medium-term initiative of creating new applied universities, which are essentially the return of polytechnics, saying that as a condition for any post-crisis support for higher education, government should insist that other than the sort of elite academic institutions, that a number of institutions should shift their missions to be more like the old kind of Woolwich speech style polytechnic of a range of applied learning courses aimed at more mature students, people who don't move away to study, offer more sort of short courses or condensed courses, more part-time courses, sandwich courses, etc. And he basically says that, we should move towards the US community college model. And again, it's an interesting proposal in that, there are obviously, and there's a need to make sure that we are offering the right sort of set of programs for a very diverse society and diverse student group. And the 3-year full-time undergraduate move away from home model is not the only one offered. But it's a sort of, again, it's a huge suggestion to move to everyone to this model. And he sort of seems very ambivalent. At the one level, he sort of says that there's not enough academic rigor in institutions outside of the academic elite, but then wants to move every single vocational subject into these apparently not very rigorous universities. So there's some sort of, he's got ambivalence around this approach. And of course, the real fundamental issue is the risk that we just recreate the binary divide. There was a reason that was removed, and that there was a disparity in funding between the traditional academic universities and the polytechnics. There was differences in prestige. And again, in a context where this government has been very clear about student choice driving how higher education works, the idea is sort of basically saying students aren't making the right choices and we need to make those choices for them, or as he puts it, sort of slightly restrict the choices at HE level to get the right outcomes.
So there's lots in here and lots that probably going to make the sector quite nervous. One of the things that jumped out at me was his suggestion of selective and conditional bailouts to respond to COVID, to create these applied universities and undo the binary divide as he talks about. And Debbie, the policy exchange reports are read in government and they are influential. Do you think this will carry any weight?
Well, I think like everything, these ideas influence government, but they are also influenced by what is perceived to be the mood in government. So it's the traffic is two way. Certainly, some of these ideas speak to themes that we're all very familiar with from the Augur Review, the need to boost level 4 and 5, the need to have more kind of seamless sequencing between further and higher education and the perceived need to kind of tackle the perennial problem of low value degrees, though the specific courses are so rarely actually identified and called out. I think the thing about Guthart, and I think this does probably reflect some thinking in government, despite the best efforts of universities, is that he's just really, really comfortable with the existing hierarchy of subjects and universities, and he sort of sees the, and he sees that as sort of fixed and correct, and he's clearly quite comfortable with the distinction between academic and vocational, except when it comes to medicine, engineering, law, which he considers to be higher vocational. And I think from the government's perspective, if the question is how do we achieve our objectives with the sort of with the minimum level of effort, disruption, and resource, which is always, should always be the question when you're making policy choices, because there's no point in disrupting unnecessarily. I think a lot of these goals could probably be achieved using policy levers that already exist, funding policy levers, perhaps, selective student number controls, without having to create a thing called an applied university. I mean, that's just a sort of branding question, isn't it? And so I don't imagine that the kind of, we'll sort of see a universal relegation of particular kinds of university, which do deliver very high quality education, as we know, across the academic and vocational, if you accept that divide. The exception, of course, is when if in the circumstances, if a university did get into financial trouble, and of course the government has no control over whether that those universities are specialist universities, you know, big civic universities, research intensive universities. So in some cases, it may then be possible to say, right, well, we need you to do more with the local FE college or whatever it is as a condition of bailout. But unless you're planning a sort of wholesale reform of the sector and being interventionist, then you've got very little control over exactly how and where that happens.
And Rachel, how do these ideas play out in Scotland, where the landscape looks rather different when it comes to these themes?
Indeed, and I've got to be honest, I did let out a little sigh when I read the paper. I absolutely agree with the maxim, never waste a good crisis. And I think I think absolutely there is an expectation that there may be some sectoral reform as a result of the pandemic. However, I'm not sure this is it. And certainly in Scotland, we have already had widespread reform of the FE college sector in particular, with the merger of numbers of colleges across Scotland to create kind of super colleges that would have very clear articulation pathways with HEIs. I mean, I do think that the notion of applied courses just seems a little dated to me, and it does give this impression that universities are not focused on real world problems and providing skills for society. And I think that's untrue and a little bit unfair. I also think when I was reading through the paper, it kind of gave rise to more questions than it provided answers for. You know, when we talk about the Industrial Revolution 4.0, we need to be training people for jobs that don't yet exist. So how would any HE provider be able to manage that? I also wasn't really clear. I mean, the report acknowledges that some sectors could shrink and others would gallop ahead. Great. But is the training that would be provided to support the galloping sectors or to rebuild the failing ones? I wasn't really quite sure. It seemed to me that the paper itself was full of some contradiction, and it referenced low value degrees, but it didn't really call those out in a clear way. So I'm also not quite sure what low value degrees are. I think there are definitely some challenges with the proposals that are being put forward. Of course, you know, the training or retraining grant of £3,000 would also be used up very quickly, I think. I'm not sure where that would come from or what it would be expected to cover and how employment relevant it would be and how that could be potentially determined. One of the interesting things actually in Scotland of late is that the Scottish Funding Council have just invested in micro-credentials across the sector. So the University of Glasgow is one of many universities that won a bid for investment from the SFC to host 10-week online micro-credential programmes that would give 10 credits. So it would be credits that could be built towards degree study. And these are all focused on upskilling. So, you know, ones that we have are around, leading change, leadership in health management care, absolutely programmes that are linked in to particular sectors and career pathways. And actually, that might be something that we see much more of in the sector over the years to come.
I'm Josie Clewer, a partner at EY. I've recently contributed to a pop-up think tank called Our Other National Debt, which brings together policy proposals for sectors which have contributed the most to the national effort over recent months. My essay is called We Haven't Had Enough of Experts, and in it I argue that expertise has had a really rough ride over the last few years. But COVID has shone a light on the amazing science going on, and it's really shown the public the value to society of those people who toil away in labs analysing data to push human knowledge and understanding just that little bit further. And I believe we can use this moment to make the case for expertise more broadly in society and what I call the expertise infrastructure that underpins it, so universities, research institutes.
Next up, the coronavirus bill in Scotland has some measures around student accommodation that are being looked at very closely, I think, across the UK. Rachel, can you talk us through what it does?
Yes, so the Scottish Accommodation Bill, basically notice periods for student accommodation in Scotland are to be introduced as part of emergency coronavirus legislation to be lodged at the Scottish Parliament this week. In essence, what that means is that students currently tied to a contract in halls of residence or other purpose-built student accommodation would be able to give 7 days' notice before ending their lease. Subject to Parliament's approval of the legislation, new agreements entered into by students whilst the law is in force will also have a 28-day notice period to leave as well. So students won't be held liable for accommodation they cannot use as a result of the pandemic and lockdown.
David, what can we learn from this approach for the rest of the UK?
As you can imagine, I think students in other parts of the UK are looking very closely at the provisions in Scotland and wanting to replicate them elsewhere. In Scotland, it's sort of closing a gap in the legislation, if you like, in the those students in the private rented sector, shared houses, shared flats, already can give that notice and be released from their contracts with 20 days notice, which and that's true of all of that type of accommodation in Scotland, not just students. Whereas that's not true at all in England, Wales or Northern Ireland. And so it will be a bigger shift in a way, a bigger concession of principle for that to be introduced in other parts of the UK. But I think it's very much something that students are looking very closely at, partly because we've got a system and a way that the student accommodation market works, where much of the marketing and the encouragement to sign up for student accommodation is done months and months in advance, in some cases November and December of the year before. So students have signed up to accommodation contracts for an academic year, 9 months in, or so in advance. And so, you know, for many of students now, plans are going to change quite radically. They don't know if they're going to go back to in-person study or study at all, perhaps. There was some suggestion that 30% had already signed up to a contract for next year in some statistics that came out yesterday. And so for many students looking ahead, so not just those that are in accommodation now and might want to leave where that's not already possible, it's actually looking at what's going to happen next year and the contracts that people have signed up so far in advance and yet have discovered that things have changed. And indeed, for NUS, we are really concerned that this model of doing things, even without coronavirus, is disadvantaging students and as tenants and putting too much power in the hands of landlords and letting agencies. And we think that, that this needs a complete change, not just for this year and for this crisis, but for the benefit of students in the longer term.
I mean, the one grey area, and actually it'd be interesting to see how this is implemented, if it is indeed passed, is for those students entering to new accommodation contracts during the lifetime of the bill, you know, they will be able to give 28 days notice if they are able to provide COVID-related reasons for that. But actually, how we determine whether someone is leaving the accommodation as a result of COVID-related reasons or actually just because they've changed their mind, and that will make it quite difficult, I think, for halls of residence to model impact, actually, because we just don't yet know what that legislation will look like in full.
So, that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes. Don't forget you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Or find the feed you need on wonky.com/podcast. And if you fancy appearing as a guest on The Wonky Show, drop us an email on team@wonky.com and we'll be in touch. So thanks to David, Rachel, Debbie, and everyone at Team Wonky for making it happen behind the scenes. And until next week, stay wonky.